Hello again, and welcome back to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets podcast. This week, we'll be talking about the issue of the 12th of December, which is our penultimate issue of the year. We're all very busy at the moment producing the bumper double issue, which comes out on the 19th of December. So once again, we are woefully underprepared for today's podcast. Nevertheless, there's plenty to talk about still, and to join me today to talk about what's been going on are Graham Davis.
Hello, John.
And Julia Bradshaw.
Hi, John.
Hello, Julia. Hello, Graham. This week we're going to talk, well, apart from the more general news, which Graham will come on to in a minute, we're going to talk Tesco, which has, again, had another shocker. Julia is going to talk us through that. Julia is also going to talk to us about booze. It's the time of year where we all like to eat, drink and be merry. But we're going to see if there's still money to be made in that sector. Julia is also going to talk to us, again, about booze, wine investing, which is something that's been notoriously difficult for private investors to access, and at least to access and actually make money. But Julia thinks she's met someone who has a good way of actually accessing what is quite an interesting market that's proved to be a source of decent returns over time if you've known what you're doing. And then we're going to be dialed in by Philip Bryland, who's written this week's cover feature on Best Bosses. He's crunched some numbers to see who stacks up, who measures up as the best bosses in the FTSE. And it's quite an interesting piece. Okay, so Graham, let's start with the news. What's been going on this week?
Well, it's been fun. It's been a busy week. Normally it calms down a little bit this time of year, but there's been plenty going on this week. In the 7 day section, we're looking at the retail news. Black Friday, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Julia, when people were fighting over televisions in the aisles Thursday night, Friday morning, very unseemly behaviour. But anyway, it seems to have worked for the UK retailers a bit more than the US. US retailers didn't have such a great time of Black Friday. It seems to be it's working in the UK though. Sales. Let's have a look. The Black Friday online sales were up 37.5% on the same day last year. Apparently this year, and that means overall November retail sales, because it was the last Friday in November, were up by 2.2% overall, or 0.9% on a like-for-like basis. So better news for the retailers. Whether it makes up for, it's certainly on the clothing side of things. I know Julia's been looking at some of these companies in the last couple of days. They had a tough time in September and October because it was very warm. Now, whether this Black Friday phenomenon and the weather bomb that we've seen in the last few days turned things a bit cold, whether that's going to help, I don't know. Julia, I don't know what your thoughts are. You've been looking at Supergroup today and companies like that.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, for Supergroup, I don't think Black Friday will have helped too much, really.
Mm. What about the weather bomb?
The weather bomb, pow. Yes. I mean, that clearly is good news for Supergroup, because one of their big sellers is their jackets, their winter jackets. But I mean, I doubt that that's really going to make up for a diabolical September, which they've just had and just reported. And they've got a lot of stock to clear too. So I think it's going to take, I think there might be a little bit more pain ahead on that front.
Well, I've just, you know, the cold weather has hit us with a vengeance. It has got noticeably chillier in the last few days. I mean, I actually popped into Debenhams about 3 weeks ago to buy a coat, and you know the sales there were extraordinary. I mean, the level of discounting was huge.
Yeah, it is. The level of discounting is massive. Although I have noticed as well that Debenhams has pulled back on some of its sale items that it had on, was it Black Friday? I think it was Black Friday. It had lots of stuff on sale, and a lot of those prices now are back to full price.
So are they just trying to protect margins now? I mean, the margins must be getting hammered across the piece here.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the same way around Christmas. It's highly promotional, and margins do get hammered. And you have to, you know, if you want to get your sales through and end up with a clean stock position at the end, you have to push those sales through. And one way to do that is discounting, unfortunately. And I mean, although, you know, you said Cyber Monday was up, what, 35% or something on last year?
Black Friday, apparently, was up 37%.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to bear in mind, too, with a lot of clothing retailers, online sales are growing and they're great, but they come at a lower margin, don't they? So...
Well, we talked earlier in the week about N Brown. They said things have got better there.
Yeah, things have gotten better there. Thankfully, for our tip, they did have a very difficult start to the year, but in October and November, things started to look up a little bit. So yeah, things are looking better for N Brown, which is good. Mm. And you know, the US, the experiment over in the US seems to be ticking along. And their trials with bricks and mortar stores as well are going pretty well. So, yeah, okay. Keep the faith in N Brown, I think.
One thing to say here, I mean, this, okay, the retailers getting hammered on margin, maybe, but surely as us as consumers, it's a good time. It's Christmas. We're getting things cheaper than they ever have been. I was looking at some research out this week from Good Housekeeping, which suggests that your Christmas meal is going to cost you less to cook and buy and cook than it has done for several years this year.
It
apparently
certainly will.
£2.66 per person you can cook a Christmas meal for now. Probably not you, John, because you're a vegetarian.
Food prices are
it's always been cheap for me. Mm.
and you know, you've got places like, I think it was Lidl I was in the other day, where we bought a stuffed duck, and it was surprisingly tasty.
Yep.
And who would have thought?
Who would have thought that? Yes. I mean, we might as well, while we're talking about grocery, turn to Tesco, which has had yet another shocking announcement this week.
Shocking, false profit warning. Yeah, another profit warning.
Mm. Talk us through what's happened there.
Well, things are a lot worse than anyone thought they would be. Although this shouldn't really come as much of a surprise, because they've just had such a diabolical time, really. And the new chief executive is, you know, he's got a lot of work ahead of him. And the question is, I think, now whether the shares have hit rock bottom. And I think a lot of analysts called this a little bit too early. A couple of months ago, people were saying, right, you know, this is the bottom and we're gonna get back in. But we kept the shares on a sell. And I think that was the right call, because there's a lot more to come. And especially when, I mean, it's not just a question of falling volumes, falling sales, you know, bad stores, bad products. It's also this whole slightly dubious way that Tesco was accounting for some of its income. I mean, you add that to the mix and you just know that there's a lot more pain, really, in the pipeline.
Yeah, because the statement this week talks about the way Tesco interacts with its suppliers.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we haven't got much detail there, but it's not well known for giving its suppliers especially generous terms. You know,
it's
changed the profit out.
Bad,
so I mean, what happens here? I mean, this does this have an enormous potential impact on profits in the future? I mean, I think even this year they're talking about, you know, what level of profit fall are they talking about, or, you know, the shortfall of expectations. But, you know, it's huge.
It was pretty big, and I think in the second half they said something like profits were coming at 15 million. Was that right or something?
I'm not sure. They said full year trading profit will not exceed 1.4 billion, which is 20 to 30% below the expectations.
Yeah, but which implies that in the second half profits will only be something.
They've barely made a profit.
Meager.
Yeah.
15 million.
It was 15 million. Yeah.
So I mean, you know,
which is shocking.
We don't exactly know what's going on to have done this.
We don't know what's going on, and Dave Lewis, who's the new chief executive, hasn't really been very clear on what's going on. He hasn't unveiled his strategy, but I think he said specifically that there would be more in January. I think he said January 10th or 8th. There'd be a lot more information coming out. So I think we'll get the full terms on, you know, how they're going to deal with their suppliers, how they're going to recognize income. They said in the results as well that they were retraining loads of sort of senior management. Senior or management, which suggests that they're basically telling them that this is how you operated before, that's bad. Mm. This is the way you need to operate now.
I mean,
this is good.
This is root and branch. This is a complete overhaul of potentially even the culture that's operated.
The culture of the institution.
And you know, Tesco's was, you know, a lot of its success was put down to the culture that it had. Mm-hmm. And he's changing everything. They don't call him drastic Dave for nothing.
No. Yes. And I mean, the big question is what they'll do with their overseas businesses too, whether they'll be maybe selling some of those off or whether they'll continue, because they're doing really badly. And also there's speculation that the full year dividend will be cut.
Yeah, and a rights issue potentially as well, they're talking about.
That's a possibility too.
And
so.
it's got lots of little, you know, sort of sub-brands.
Giraffe restaurants.
Harrison Hall.
It's gone into so many areas. A lot of people say, well, it's just spread itself too thin. Yep. It should concentrate on what it does best, which is grocery.
In the UK.
And you know, the thing that struck me, and, you know, going back to the editorial I wrote last week in response to a James Montier paper about how companies run and whose benefit they run for, and this concept of shareholder value. James Montier, GMO, his big thing is, well, customers did better when they thought about the customer first. And this seems to be what Dave Lewis is coming in and saying at Tesco.
Yeah, I mean, the theme running through the results, arguably, was it's all about customers, putting customers first, customer service, better products. So, you know, that's a good thing, because if you focus on your customers and they like you, it's good for business. Mm. So it's common sense, really. And a lot of the times, big companies lose sight of that because they're focused too much on their shareholders.
Mm. Well, they often talk about it, but talking about customers and actually putting them first is a different matter altogether.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, I saw some. I mean, if you've seen the John Lewis ad or the Waitrose ad, rather, this Christmas, then, you know, it is about, you know, our staff own the business, therefore we treat our customers better because we
they care.
They care. We care about the business.
I mean, which is another, and Sports Direct had results today. today. And I mean, we're not going to, they won't be in the magazine until next week, but they had a pretty good set of results, and they have a very well-known, very generous employee bonus scheme. Mm. So they treat their employees well, and their employees offer top customer service. Well,
not necessarily the ones that are on the 0 hours contract.
No, but the ones that are on the bonus scheme are incentivized, just like the staff at John Lewis and Waitrose.
Mm. I've got to say, I mean, Sports Direct is an interesting company. You know, Dave Lewis and Mike Ashley has obviously come in for some strong criticism over the years for his approach to corporate governance and his general approach towards the stock market. I actually think he does a pretty good job at Sports Direct, and you know, whilst in the past those shops were chaotic, shambolic, and had a reputation for cheapness, and deservedly so. You know, my family spends a lot of money in their you know, kids' PE kit. It's great. The expansion of the ranges, they seem to be going up market. The stores are looking, you know, a lot better than they used to. But it's still very affordable. And I think he's doing a cracking job there.
Yeah, he is.
And the staff are, I give you that, the staff, whenever I've been in Sports Direct, the staff are very good.
Helpful.
Very attentive.
Okay. So Tesco, that's possibly enough of that. I mean, you know, except to perhaps ask the question, when do we think we would perhaps reassess our case, our view on it? You know, when would we be looking for signs that we might?
We'll certainly wait until January till we get a little bit more clarity from management on what's going on. We'll reassess the situation, and if we think that the worst is behind us, maybe we'll reassess the situation. But I'm still quite wary of Tesco, to be perfectly honest. Mm. So, we'll keep a close eye on it. And as soon as we think the tide's changing, we'll change our view. But it probably won't be for a couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, as I say this week, I'm happy, and I presume you are as well, Julia, to miss a little bit of upside if the recovery, if the tide does start to turn, just to make sure that it's entrenched.
Mm. And because we've had so many profit warnings, if there's even if there's sort of a whiff of a little bit of bad news, there'll be a huge overreaction, no doubt. Mm. So that can't be good.
I mean, is it worth perhaps chatting briefly about, you know, the read across from the sector? Because, you know, Sainsbury's has had a pretty horrible performance this year too. Do we think, I mean, you know, some of these problems are obviously of Tesco's own making, but I mean, is this a structural problem that has to be overcome by the sector as a whole?
I mean, well, it is. And it's, I mean, it's partly its sentiment. So it is going to affect Sainsbury's and Morrison's. But you're right. There is a massive structural change going on in the food retail market, and it's unprecedented, really. It's the, you know, the not just sort of falling food prices, not just the advent of the internet and online shopping, but we've got these discount retailers who've come in, Aldi and Lidl. And unlike a few years ago when they tried to conquer the UK market and sort of failed, they've done a really good job now, and they're really popular. And what's really frightening the likes of Tesco and Sainsbury's is they're attracting middle-class shoppers, and that's not what they were doing before. A few years ago, you would never be caught dead in an Aldi or a Lidl as a middle-class shopper. And now, you know, everyone's there and everyone's at it. So,
well, I think it goes back to the point you made about the, you know, the stuffed duck of surprisingly high quality. I think,
yeah.
You know, they're matching up to the big boys in terms of the quality of products.
Good quality, good range of products, and great prices.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's something that should really sort of strike fear into the hearts of the senior management at Sainsbury's. And
well, let's hope they do something about it. They certainly didn't feature highly on the bosses ranking that we're going to talk about with Philip shortly. Talking of bargains, Graham and I, we stumbled across a website this week, market.com.
Market.com, John, yes.
And how much does everything on market.com cost, Graham?
Everything's £5, John.
Everything is £5.
Just like a proper old school street market, which is funny because it is actually connected to Camden Market.
What a brilliant segue that was.
Yeah, exactly. And Camden Market's in the news this week because it's going to be floated on AIM.
Oh my gosh, the whole market.
The whole market is owned by Market Tech, which is controlled by an Israeli entrepreneur called Teddy Sagi.
Who we know very well.
Ah, yes.
The Playtech founder.
How interesting.
And he's patched together a few bits and bobs of real estate in Camden, all the different bits of market, and he's patched them all together into one, and it's looking for a valuation of £750 million.
Okay, do we have a view on whether that's realistic? Do we not know enough about the business yet to really know whether that represents decent value or not?
I mean, it's prime real estate in London. I mean, you know, there's got to be some value on the assets, and there is development potential there. I know they're building, they have plans to smarten up some of the areas of the market to build new retail bits. They're also talking about building a bit of residential and a school in one of the, you know, it's looking like a proper development company. So I don't really have the property expertise to value it in that way, but Yeah. It looks very interesting.
So okay. Are they looking to get rid of some of the sort of more sort of scrappy...
I haven't been to Camden Market in a long time.
Market holders, stall holders.
I don't know what it's like these days. But last time I went, it wasn't... Yeah, there was corners of it that were a bit less
than
this. Yeah. I mean, Teddy Sagi is an interesting character. I mean, he you know, I'm not going to say that he's Israel's answer to Mike Ashley, but, I mean, he has... You know, there is a similar love-hate between him and the city.
Yeah.
He's, again, a guy not well-known for necessarily following the rules exactly as they're laid out in terms of the way, you know, corporate governance is expected to be handled. You know, there's been a lot of, with Playtex, sort of intercompany purchases, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
but he seems to deliver the goods in terms of the share price performance. And Playtex done all right over the years.
Yeah, Playtex, what, a £2 billion company now? Playtex, yeah, a big operation. And look at the job it did for William Hill on the digital side of things. And now it's doing the same job for Ladbrokes. You know, Playtex a proper company.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Camden Markets, you know, again, this is something that it does look interesting to me. We work around the corner to Borough Market. Mm. And, you know, Borough Market is something that, you know, certainly the years I've been working here has become very much a tourist destination. It's
absolutely
moved up market. Mm. And, you know, you can certainly see the value that a bit of estate management can create in something, in an asset like that. I think this is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Definitely one to watch.
No, it is. I think they want the shares to be trading before Christmas as well, so it's going to happen quite quickly.
Okay. Well, at which more point we'll have a view on whether we think they're worth buying.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on. I think probably that's enough on the general news front. Julia, a couple of things you've written this week. Let's go through them briefly. Sector focus, booze.
Yeah, we did a little update on the booze sector, which in the UK is basically just three companies, CNC, yep, SAB Miller and Diageo. And just kind of outlining how the sector is done and where it is and where we think it's going to go. And it's, if any listeners are interested, they can also see the video on the website.
Yeah.
Which we've done. Basically, it's been an interesting time for beverage makers this year. They had a bit of a wobble at the start of the year. It's a well-documented decline in emerging markets, the weakening economies there, and the weakening currencies too, was quite painful for the likes of Diageo and for SAB Miller. Mm. The anti-extravagance measures in China really, and is still hitting sales at Diageo because whiskey, sort of premium whiskey, was a big seller in China. But now, sort of the stocks are sort of rebounding a little, and there's a sense that, you know, as the markets are becoming slightly more volatile, that the beverage sector is more of a defensive play. Really, the shares aren't particularly cheap; they're not particularly expensive, but they're sort of trading in line, I'd say, with their historical average, maybe a little bit more expensive. So those are the main themes in terms of where we're at now. The big, most interesting thing is the potential for M&A, of course, in the sector, and we've had a lot of sort of rumors brewing. No pun intended. About SAB Miller and Anheuser-Busch, mm-hmm, too. So, I mean, the general consensus seems to be that SAB Miller is in play and might be at some point an acquisition target, because the sector is sort of increasingly, even though it is quite sort of distilled down to just a few sort of big players, there's still potential for M&A because they've been spending the past few years streamlining, cutting costs, and now, you know, some of them are quite cash rich, and now it's a question of whether, you know, how to sort of consolidate that and what to do with all that cash.
Mm, give it back. And I think one of the things you mentioned in this week's piece is that there's, you know, the possibility of, you know, nice dividend increase on the way next year.
Again. Yeah, that's another thing that there might be, exactly, dividend increase next year. And so we'll see. So it's sort of slow and steady and potential for further M&A. Those are the main themes, effectively. And one thing I didn't mention, I think, in the sector focus was the craft beer revolution too, which is just an interesting side note. Which is, I mean, it's slightly worrying for some of the big guys, but because it is a big and growing sector, and in the US it's massive.
But people like SAB have invested in craft brewers.
Yeah, and I mean that's they've been busy snapping up a lot of small brewers and things like that. So they do have exposure to the market, and increasing exposure, but it's just an interesting thing to be aware of, because you've got the likes of BrewDog here, you've got Meantime, you've got Brewers Union, you've got lots of little ones sort of that are sort of taking market share as well.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned BrewDog, because there's a nice link there with Camden Market, because you wrote about BrewDog. It's one of the first things you did when you joined us.
I did a blog a couple of years ago.
But no, they're quite interesting. They brew lager of varying strengths. Tactical Nuclear Penguin, I think, was their super strength lager. But they also open bars, which is an interesting strategy, having raised a lot of money in this sort of self-managed share issue.
Yeah, Equity for Punks.
Which is really, really quite interesting and quite successful for them.
It is
as well.
Interesting. It's questionable whether or not as an investor you'd ever get your money back.
Mm.
But you don't really invest in a company like that to see a massive return. You invest because you believe in the company, you believe in beer, and you believe in the craft brew revolution and that kind of thing. And as a shareholder, you get massive perks as well, and you can attend the AGM and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So that's what it's really meant for. And you're right, they're opening up bars all over the country. There's one in Shepherd's Bush, I noticed recently.
Oh, did they have one there as well?
Yeah, there's one there. So yeah, it's interesting actually.
Well, I think as well they, just if I remember rightly, they did a deal with Sierra Nevada, which is one of the US craft brewers, quite a big one. And they've got some really experienced management on board there who've built and sold these businesses up before. So, you know, BrewDog might be one of the assets that one of these big, you know, global brewers might be looking out for.
By all means, we said that in the blog, I think, that if BrewDog becomes successful, that it could potentially be snapped up by one of the bigger guys. So, you know, watch this space.
So who knows, that little lifestyle investment that quite a few people made could end up being quite lucrative after all.
Including my brother-in-law.
Oh, did you buy some?
Well, I bought a share for Christmas.
Oh, you bought
one. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Maybe I shouldn't say that on a podcast.
But no, it's fine. I think we can. Full disclosure here. Okay, so I mean, let's turn from beer and spirits to wine, which you also wrote about this week.
I did, yeah. An interesting little piece, actually, on investing in fine wines. We do a wine investment piece pretty much every year around Christmas, don't we? Something similar.
Well, yeah, we've done a few. But I mean, this one has a slightly different flavour to it.
Yeah, it's a different...
Because you've met a guy called Nick Martin who's developed something that's really quite interesting and can give retail investors, you know, the exposures that have been previously hard to get, that only the very wealthy or institutional wine.
Exactly. I mean, traditionally it's quite... I mean, you can invest in fine wine, but traditionally it's been pretty difficult. You have to go through a wine merchant, and it is a sort of long and protracted process, and you need a lot of time on your hands. So it really has only been the preserve of very wealthy people. And Nick Martin, who I met, he's a really nice, very affable guy. He was a wine lover, started investing in wine, and then he was sort of tearing his hair out because it was so complicated. And he thought, I can do better. And he comes from sort of data, he's a data geek, self-confessed data geek, comes from a technical background. So he thought, I can build a platform to let ordinary people gain exposure to basically the secondary wine market, which is what he's done, which is wineowners.com. And it's really easy to use, and it's kind of like Hargreaves Lansdown. I mean, that's the best comparison of the wine world. So you can keep track of all of your wines, even the old stuff that you've got sort of, you know, if you have a cellar or wherever in your closet.
Or in your bottle of mold wine that's been sitting in the cupboard for 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. So you can keep all of that on this online portfolio, and it also... As well as that, you can trade the wines. So you can sort of trade it openly on the free sort of secondary market. And he's facilitated that. And it's small. I mean, it's not huge, but it's sort of growing gradually. And it is a good way if you want exposure maybe to start out. Sort of, yeah, it's a good platform basically.
Okay, and the returns for wine, I mean, looking at there's a couple of graphs you've provided, they're pretty good. I mean, so the wine owners have developed their own index, but you know, if you break it down then by some of the various types of wine, you know, there are some really strong performers there, hundreds of percent over.
Yeah, they have. And I mean, some of that was down to Bordeaux has been doing well. Until the bubble burst, Bordeaux did really well until about 2011 when the bubble burst on the back of Chinese demand, which then sort of collapsed. But yeah, the returns have been pretty solid. And I think Nick Martin was keen to stress that the main thing with wine is, even though Bordeaux is sort of the is responsible for the lion's share of sort of fine wine investing, that the key is diversification, like with equities.
Yep.
So don't just look at Bordeaux, look at Burgundy, look at Californian wines, look at Italian wines, do a lot of research, see what you can get, and yeah, just go for it. And the returns can be pretty good. And they're not, I mean, they're long term though. I think Barry Brothers and Nick Martin both say sort of 10 years is kind of the sort of minimum that you want to be looking at potentially.
Well, I think that seems very sensible. You know, we would encourage people to take a similarly long-term approach with equities too.
Sure.
You know, and when I was reading through some of the tips that Nick provides, you know, it does seem like there are strong similarities. You know, the diversification thing that you mentioned for one, but you know, there is certain the hunting for value approach that you can adopt as well, which quite, you know, it's almost like stock picking.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange to think that you can hunt for value in a wine, but you know, Nick says, well, if you find a wine that you think is undervalued but in demand and its peers are doing really well, just like the same way you'd stock pick, like you said, then you know, it could be in a few years' time, it could make for a good investment. And also, fine wine is always going to be in demand because people like wine, they like drinking it. So you kind of have this sort of supply and demand side of things there. So it's not necessarily as risky as some people might think it is, although it is unregulated, so you do have to be a bit careful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I thought it was a great article, really, really very interesting indeed, and really highlighted how little I know about wine.
Oh, yeah, and Nick's predictions are very useful if any of our listeners are interested. His 2015 predictions can be sort of a helping hand if they want to get onto the wine investing ladder.
Okay, well, I've got one prediction that all the wine in my cupboard will not exist. Okay, thank you, Julia. Now I think it's time to get Philip Ryland on the phone, who is going to talk us through the excellent cover feature he's written this week. Hello, Philip.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm pretty well.
Good. So the feature this week is called The Best Bosses. We've got a picture of four of them on the front cover, looking very usual suspects. But you know, it's a little bit more complex than that. Talk us through the thinking behind this feature.
Okay. Well, it began as an exercise to see how FTSE bosses really performed, and whether we could spot some sort of common factors that that led to that good performance, if indeed the performance was good. So I started crunching some data, and the data threw up the odd yet intriguing possibility that bosses on average really did outperform, implying that, hey, they really are worth all that money they in effect pay themselves. And the other odd thing was that the longer the boss was in the job, the better the outperformance seemed. So this was really rather amazing, but it also defied belief. And then we found, not so much when we had crunched the data, but when we sat back and thought, okay, what's really happening here, then we kind of realized that two statistical quirks were driving this outperformance by FTSE bosses. The first is what's called survivor bias, which I'll explain in a minute if you want me to.
Yes, please.
And the second one, the second big factor, was the fact that our averages were based on the unweighted returns of the 100 stocks in the FTSE index, whereas, of course, in the index itself, those returns are weighted towards big companies. The bigger the company, the bigger the value, the market value of the company, the greater its effect on the market's performance. And it just so happens that in the past few years, the performance of the biggest companies in the market, the likes of Vodafone, Shell, HSBC, they've been particularly poor performers. So in effect, therefore, the smaller companies within the index have tended to do better, and that dragged up the average returns for our bosses.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think you say there's a stat. Five companies account for almost 29% of the FTSE 100's weighted performance. So,
that's it, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Extraordinary. Okay, so in essence, what we're saying is that they're all pretty average. And I mean, it's not necessarily the outcome we wanted, because, you know, it has been notoriously difficult to work out whether, as you say, bosses are worth the money we pay them. You know, isn't this somewhat disappointing, that this outcome?
Well, I'm not sure that, you know, can the facts ever be disappointing? I'm not sure about that. I mean, there were some intriguing things some intriguing factors that cropped up along the way. One thing that I particularly wanted to examine was whether or not overseas bosses tend to do better than UK-based bosses. You know, we hear a lot about the global marketplace for bosses now, and it just so happens that in the UK, the FTSE companies in the UK, they are particularly internationally minded. If you look at the number of overseas bosses who run UK companies, basically 43 of the 100 are run by guys and just one or two girls from overseas, whereas the global average for the 500 biggest companies in the world is something like, I think it's 12%. So you've got an awful lot of foreigners running UK FTSE companies, and I kind of wondered if that would be a factor which might point up performance or lack of performance. In fact, as far as one can tell, the overseas bosses, they don't really do terribly well at all. Their average position, this is 43 out of 100, so that's a pretty big sample in 100. You would think their average position should be pretty much round about 50. Well, it's not that far from 50, it's 55th. But it's not a terribly good performance. Overseas bosses, they tend not to do as well as they should amongst the very best performers. and they tend to do worse than they should amongst the very worst performers.
Mm. Could this also be explained partly by that waiting quirk that you talked about, that, say, Vodafone, for example, is run by Vittorio Colao, who's obviously a foreign boss.
He's Italian, John.
Indeed, he is Italian. But, you know, so the, presumably the waiting there...
Yeah, it could be, because the miners, mining companies have done particularly badly, and mining companies, probably because of where they tend to come from, Australia, South Africa, they also tend to be run by foreigners.
Mm. I think you mentioned Ivan Glasenberg, who comes from everywhere, according to...
He has four nationalities.
Incredible.
He comes from almost anywhere, everywhere. Another factor that I was interested to examine is whether or not there's a link between age and performance. In other words, you would ask yourself, do you want your boss to be young or do you want him to be older than average? The average is about 54 and a half. Can you spot, an improvement in performance with the age of the boss? The long and the short of that proposition lends itself very nicely to a regression model, but the long and the short of it is there seems to be absolutely no correlation between age and performance. So that went right out of the window. Can I mention MBAs and accountants, which was rather intriguing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you'd expect the best qualified to do best. Is that necessarily the case?
I'm not sure about that, but it was interesting and a bit surprising to me because the UK is supposed to favour financial engineers to run our companies. The Germans prefer real engineers to run their companies. UK companies prefer to the shareholders prefer them to be run by financial engineers. So you expect to see a lot of accountants running UK companies, UK FTSE companies. In fact, there's only 12 out of 100 run by accountants, whereas it's 20 run by MBAs. Yet the MBAs seem to perform disproportionately badly. The accountants perform better than average. Somewhere I have some statistics. Can I ever find these while I'm scraping around? Naturally, of course, John, I can't find that particular
stat
as I'm talking about it. But the average performance of MBAs was disappointing. The average performance of accountants, however, that was really rather good. There's nothing scientific there, but that was kind of intriguing.
Did we find any factors that really pointed to strong out, or that shared the characteristic of strong performance?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. The strongest characteristic is age in the job. In other words, the bosses who are most likely to produce an average sort of performance will have been in their job for an average length of time. The bosses who are most likely to produce a good or a bad level of performance, in other words, the guys at the extremes of performance, extremely good, extremely bad, they will tend to have been in their job for the shortest length of time. That finding was pretty clear if you look at the performance of the whole of the 100 bosses in the index. If you just take the, and this is perhaps more significant, if you just take the 62 bosses who had been in their job for at least 2.5 years, if you say to yourself, okay, less than 2.5 years, that's not enough to judge, so we'll forget about all the guys and girls who haven't been there being the boss for 2.5 years.
Indeed, including poor old Dave Lewis at Tesco, who's propping up the list,
poor old,
sadly.
Yeah, Dave Lewis, look, we can be sure Dave Lewis's relative performance will improve in time. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
Absolutely,
he and Mike Coop, the two Mike Coop of Sainsbury's, those two are propping it up. But there's every chance they won't be propping it up if they're still in the job in 2 or 3 years' time. Mm. Quite where they'll be, however, is another matter.
Okay. There was another interesting point you made, another kind of anecdotal observation, which I quite liked, was that the low-profile bosses tend to do quite well, which I thought was quite interesting.
Indeed. Is it a coincidence that neither of the top two performers, the the top two performers of the core 62 companies, Simon Burrows, who runs 3i, the private equity firm.
He hasn't been there an enormously long time, so...
He has been in there...
2.5 years.
Very conveniently, he is in there at the cut-off point 2.5 years. That very fact might be significant.
Mm.
But he and Jeff Drabble of Ashstead, who are the top two long performers, neither of those two have a Wikipedia entry. And there aren't many FTSE bosses who don't have Wikipedia entries by now. Those two don't. And it's also noticeable that amongst those other top 10 performers of the guys who've been in there for more than 2.5 years, there are others, people like, Keith Cochrane at the Weir Group or Ian Gorham at Hargreaves Lansdowne, Peter Rogers at Babcock International. They're not really household names within the context of FTSE 100 bosses.
Mm. I think it's quite interesting. I desperately want to believe that there is something that we can find that helps us to spot a good manager. Because I do believe, as I say in my editorial this week, that management matters. But it is quite useful to try and put some numbers on that. And we're going to carry this on, I hope, Philip. Are we planning to?
I think the aim is to do it again in a year's time, to do it and improve it in a year's time. And maybe in a year's time, we'll look at the performance of these guys relative to the sector in which they play, rather in relation to the market as a whole. That might show up some significant results. And the other thing that I'd kind of like to do, easier said than done, but it would be nice to do it, is to factor in some sort of relationship between what, in effect, they pay themselves and their performance.
Mm.
If we do that, then we really might start to get some interesting results.
Okay, it sounds like a lot of number crunching. I think somewhere in the piece there's a plea for some assistance from someone from perhaps the world of academia to come and lend us some support here.
Yeah, well, look, I think as I said in my piece, and I think as we mentioned to each other the other day, this sort of thing is just... It's just crying out for a doctoral student to take 3 months off and a doctoral finance student to take 3 months off and crunch some numbers and come up with a PhD thesis and perhaps the basis of an exchange-traded fund and who knows what else.
Indeed, well, it's a smart beast type fund.
Based
on pools. Yeah, wonderful. Sounds good. Brilliant. Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Philip.
You're welcome.
And speak soon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, and that just about wraps up everything we wanted to talk about this week, except to run you through what else we've got in the magazine. A lot in the fund section and the personal finance section that we haven't talked about on the podcast. We've taken a look at the biotech sector, which has been a very strong performer, to see whether there's any value left there, and if so, which funds you might buy to access that. We've got a nice piece on self-invested personal pension, SIPs, which points to some unusual assets that you might put in your SIP that could indeed give you a more satisfying retirement. We've taken a look at the relationship between VCTs and EISs, the tax-efficient vehicles, and the renewable energy sector. There's been some changes in the recent autumn statement that could affect that sector, so worth taking a look there. And of course, all the usual company results, stock screens and tips. So pick that up in your nearest newsagent for the princely sum of £4.10, or on iPad or Android for £3.99. Thank you very much, and see you next week. Bye-bye.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.